wake her mother. She went into her room, already pulling off her coat. It took her a moment to realize that there was someone else there. The room was chilly, the cold air pouring in through the half-open window. On the windowsill sat Isabel. She wore high boots zipped over her jeans, her hair was loose, blowing slightly in the breeze. She looked over at Clary as she came in the room and smiled tightly. Clary went over to the window and pulled herself up beside Izzy. There was enough room for both of them, but barely. The toes of her shoes nudged up against Izzy's leg. She folded her hands over her knees and waited.
"Sorry," Isabel said finally. "I probably should have come in through the front door, but I didn't want to deal with your parents."
"Was everything okay at the council meeting?" Clary asked. "Did something happen?" Isabel laughed shortly. "Fairies agreed to the Clave's terms."
"Well, that's good, right?"
"Maybe." Magnus didn't seem to think so. Isabel exhaled. "It just... there were nasty, pointy, angry bits sticking out everywhere. It didn't seem like a victory. And they're sending Helen Blackthorne to Wrangell Island to study the wards. Get that. They want to get her away because she's got fairy blood."
"That's horrible. What about Aline?"
"Aline's going with her. She told Alec," Isabel said. "There's some uncle that's coming to take care of the Blackthorne kids and the girl, the one who likes you and Jace."
"Her name's Emma," Clary said, poking Isabel's leg with her toe.
"You could try to remember it. She did help us out."
"Yeah, it's a little hard for me to be grateful right now." Isabel ran her hands down her denim-clad legs and took a deep breath. "I know there was no other way it could have played out. I keep trying to imagine one, but I can't think of anything. We had to go after Sebastian, and we had to get out of Edom, or we all would have died anyway. But I just miss Simon. I miss him all the time, and I came here because you're the only one who misses him as much as I do."
Clary stilled. Isabel was playing with the red stone at her throat, staring out the window with the sort of fixed stare Clary was familiar with. It was the kind of stare that said, "I'm trying not to cry."
"I know," Clary said. "I miss him all the time too, just in a different way. Feels like waking up missing an arm or a leg, like there's something that's always been there that I relied on, and now it's gone."
Isabel was still staring out the window.
"Tell me about the phone call," she said.
"I don't know," Clary hesitated. "It was bad, Iz. I don't think you really want to..."
"Tell me," Isabel said through her teeth, and Clary sighed and nodded.
It wasn't as if she didn't remember. Every second of what had happened was burned into her brain. It had been 3 days after they had come back. 3 days during which all of them had been quarantined. No shadow hunter had survived a trip to a demon dimension before, and the Silent Brothers had wanted to be absolutely sure that they were carrying no dark magic with them. It had been 3 days of Clary screaming at the Silent Brothers that she wanted her Steely, she wanted a portal, she wanted to see Simon, she wanted someone to just check on him and make sure he was all right. She hadn't seen Isabel or any of the others during those days, not even her mother or Luke. But they must have done their own fair share of screaming, because the moment they had all been cleared by the brothers, a guard had appeared and guided Clary to the consul's office. Inside the office of the consul, in the guard on top of Guard Hill, was the only working telephone in Alicante. It had been enchanted to work sometime around the turn of the century by the warlock Ragnar Fell, a little before the development of fire messages. It had survived various attempts to remove it on the theory that it might disrupt the wards, as it had shown no sign of ever doing so. The only other person in the room was Gia Penhallow, and she gestured for Clary to sit.
"Magnus Bane has informed me about what happened with your friend Simon Lewis in the Demon Realms," she said. "I wish to say that I am sorry for your loss."
"He isn't dead," Clary ground out through her teeth. "At least he isn't supposed to be. Has anyone bothered to check? Has anyone looked to see if he's all right?"
"Yes," Gia said rather unexpectedly. "He is fine, living at home with his mother and sister. He seems entirely well, no longer a vampire, of course, but simply a mundane, living a very ordinary life. He appears from observation to have no recollection of the shadow world."
Clary flinched, then straightened up.
I just want to talk to him.
Gia thinned her lips.
You know the law. You cannot tell a mundane about the shadow world unless he is in danger. You cannot reveal the truth, Clary. Magnus said the demon who freed you told you as much.
The demon who freed you. So Magnus hadn't mentioned it was his father, not that Clary blamed him. She wouldn't reveal his secret either.
I won't tell Simon anything, all right? I just want to hear his voice. I need to know he's okay.
Gia sighed and pushed the phone toward her. Clary grabbed it, wondering how you dialed out of Idris. How did they pay their phone bills? Then decided, screw it. She was just going to dial as if she were in Brooklyn already. If that didn't work, she could ask for guidance. To her surprise, the phone rang and was picked up almost immediately, the familiar voice of Simon's mother echoing down the line.
Hello?
Hello?
The receiver almost slipped in Clary's hand. Her palm was damp with sweat.
Simon there?
What? Oh, yes, he's in his room, said Elaine.
Can I tell him who's calling?
Clary closed her eyes.
It's Clary.
There was a short silence, and then Elaine said,
I'm sorry, who?
Clary Frey. She tasted bitter metal in the back of her throat.
I go to St. Xavier's. It's about our English homework.
Oh, well, all right then, said Elaine. I'll go get him. She put the phone down and Clary waited. Waited for the woman who had thrown Simon out her house and called him a monster, had left him to throw up blood on his knees in the gutter to go and see if he would pick up a phone call like a normal teenager.
It wasn't her fault. It was the mark of Cain acting on her without her knowledge, turning Simon into a wanderer, cutting him away from his family, Clary told herself. But it didn't stop the burn of anger and anxiety flooding her veins.
She heard Elaine's footsteps going away, the murmur of voices, more footsteps.
Hello?
Simon's voice, and Clary almost dropped the phone. Her heart was pounding itself into pieces. She could picture him so clearly, skinny and brown-haired, propping himself against the table in the narrow hallway just past the Lewis's front door.
Simon, she said.
Simon, it's me, it's Clary. There was a pause. When he spoke again, he sounded bewildered.
Do we know each other?
Each word felt like a nail being pounded into her skin.
We have English class together, she said, which was true enough in a way.
They had had most of their classes together when Clary had still gone to mundane high school.
Mr. Price?
Oh, right. He sounded not unfriendly, cheerful enough, but baffled.
I'm really sorry. I have a total mental block for faces and names.
What's up?
Mom said it was something about homework, but I don't think we had any homework tonight.
Can I ask you something? Clary said.
About A Tale of Two Cities?
He sounded amused.
Look, I haven't read it yet. I like the more modern stuff. Catch 22, The Catcher in the Rye, anything with catch in the title, I guess.
He was flirting a little, Clary thought. He must have thought she'd called him up out of the blue because she thought he was cute. Some random girl at school whose name he didn't even know.
Who's your best friend? She asked. Your best friend in the whole world?
He was silent for a moment, then laughed.
I should have guessed this was about Eric, he said.
You know, if you wanted his phone number, you could have just asked him. Clary hung the phone up and sat staring at it as if it were a poisonous snake. She was aware of Gia's voice asking her if she was all right, asking what happened. But she didn't answer. She just set her jaw, absolutely determined not to cry in front of the consul.
You don't think maybe he was just faking it? Isabel said now. Pretending he didn't know who you were, you know, because it would be dangerous?
Clary hesitated. Simon's voice had been so blithe, so banal, so completely ordinary. Nobody could fake that.
I'm totally sure, she said. He doesn't remember us, he can't.
Izzy looked away from the window, and Clary could see the tears standing in her eyes.
I want to tell you something, Isabel said. And I don't want you to hate me.
I couldn't hate you, Clary said. Not possible.
It's almost worse, Isabel said. Than if he were dead. If he were dead, I could grieve, but I don't know what to think. He's safe. He's alive. I should be grateful.
He isn't a vampire anymore, and he hated being a vampire.
I should be happy, but I'm not happy. He told me he loved me. He told me he loved me, Clary, and now he doesn't even know who I am. If I was standing in front of him, he wouldn't recognize my face. It feels like I never mattered. None of it ever mattered or ever happened. He never loved me at all. She swiped angrily at her face. I hate it, she broke out suddenly. I hate this feeling like there's something sitting on my chest.
Missing someone?
Yes, Isabel said. I never thought I'd feel it about some boy.
Not some boy, Clary said. Simon, and he did love you, and it did matter.
Maybe he doesn't remember, but you do, I do. The Simon who's living in Brooklyn now, that's Simon the way he used to be 6 months ago. And that's not a terrible thing, he was wonderful. But he changed when you knew him, he got stronger and he got hurt and he was different. And that Simon was the one you fell in love with and who fell in love with you, so you were grieving because he's gone. But you can keep him alive a little by remembering him, we both can.
Isabel made a choking sound.
I hate losing people, she said, and there was a savage edge to her voice, the desperation of someone who had lost too much too young. I hate it.
Clary put her hand out and took Izzy's, a thin right hand, the one with the voyant's runes stretched across her knuckles.
I know, Clary said. But remember the people you've gained, too. I've gained you, I'm grateful for that.
She pressed Izzy's hand hard, and for a moment there was no response. Then Isabel's fingers tightened on hers. They sat in silence on the windowsill, their hands locked across the distance between them.
Maya sat on the couch in the apartment, her apartment now. Being pack leader paid a small salary, and she had decided to use it for rent, to keep what once had been Jordan and Simon's place, keep their things from being thrown into the street by an angry evicting landlord. Eventually, she would go through their belongings, pack up what she could, sort through the memories, exorcise the ghosts. For today, though, she was content to sit and look at what had arrived for her from Idris in a small package from Gia Penhallow. The consul hadn't thanked her for the warning she'd been given, though she had welcomed her as the new and permanent leader of the New York pack. Her tone had been cool and distant, but wrapped in the letter was a bronze seal, the seal of the head of the Praetor Lupus, the seal with which the Scott family had always signed their letters. It had been retrieved from the ruins on Long Island. There was a small note attached with two words written on it in Gia's careful hand. Begin again. You're going to be all right, I promise. It was probably the 600th time that Helen had said the same thing, Emma thought. It would probably have helped if she didn't sound more like she was trying to convince herself. Helen was nearly finished packing the belongings that she had brought to Idris. Uncle Arthur, he had told Emma to call him that too, had promised to send on the rest. He was waiting downstairs with Aline to escort Helen to the guard, where she would take the portal to Wrangell Island. Aline would follow her the next week, after the last of the treaties and votes in Alicante. It all sounded boring and complicated and horrible to Emma. All she knew was that she was sorry for ever having thought that Helen and Aline were soppy. Helen didn't seem soppy to her at all now. Just sad, her eyes red-rimmed and her hands shaking as she zipped up her bag and turned to the bed. It was an enormous bed, big enough for six people. Julian was sitting up against the headboard on one side, and Emma was on the other. You could have fit the rest of the family between them, Emma thought, but Drew, the twins, and Tavi were asleep in their rooms. Drew and Livy were cried out. Tiberius had accepted the news of Helen's departure with wide-eyed confusion, as if he didn't know what was happening or how he was expected to respond. At the last, he'd shaken her hand and solemnly wished her good luck, as if she were a colleague leaving on a business trip. She'd burst into tears.
Oh, Ty, she said, and he'd slunk away, looking horrified.
Helen knelt down now, bringing herself almost eye level with Jules where he sat on the bed.
Remember what I said, okay?
We're going to be all right, Julian parroted. Helen squeezed his hand.
I hate leaving you, she said. I'd take care of you if I could, you know that, right? I'd take over the Institute, I love you all so much.
Julian squirmed in the manner that only a 12-year-old boy could squirm upon hearing the word love.
I know, he managed.
The only reason I can leave is that I'm sure I'm leaving you all in good hands, she said, her eyes boring into his.
Uncle Arthur, you mean?
I mean you, she said, and Jules' eyes widened. I know it's a lot to ask, she added. But I also know I can depend on you. I know you can help Drew with her nightmares and take care of Livia and Tavi, and maybe even Uncle Arthur can do that too. He's a nice enough man, absent-minded, but he seems to want to try.
Her voice trailed off.
But Ty is... she sighed. Ty is special. He translates the world differently from how the rest of us do. Not everyone can speak his language, but you can. Take care of him for me, all right? He's going to be something amazing. We just have to keep the clay from understanding how special he is. They don't like people who are different. She finished, and there was a bitterness in her tone. Julian was sitting up straight now, looking worried. Ty hates me, he said. He fights me all the time.
Ty loves you, said Helen. He sleeps with that bee you gave him. He watches you all the time. He wants to be like you. He's just...
It's hard, she finished, not sure how to say what she wanted to. That Ty was jealous of the way Julian so easily navigated the world, so easily made people love him. That what Julian did every day without thinking seemed to Ty like a magic trick. Sometimes it's hard when you want to be like someone but you don't know how. A sharp furrow of confusion appeared between Julian's brows, but he looked up at Helen and nodded.
I'll take care of Ty, he said. I promise.
Good. Helen stood up and kissed Julian quickly on the top of his head. Because he's amazing and special. You all are. She smiled over his head at Emma.
You too, Emma,
she said, and her voice tightened on Emma's name as if she was going to cry. She closed her eyes, hugged Julian one more time, and fled out of the room, grabbing her suitcase and coat as she went. Emma could hear her running downstairs and then the front door closing amid a murmur of voices. Emma looked over at Julian. He was sitting rigidly upright, his chest rising and falling as if he'd been running. She reached over quickly and took his hand, traced onto the inside of his palm.
W-H-A-T-S-W-R-O-N-G.
You heard Helen, he said in a low voice. She trusts me to take care of them. Drew, Tavi, Livy, Ty, my whole family, basically. I'm 12, Emma, and I'm going to have 4 kids. Anxiously, she started to write. N-O-Y-O-U-W-O-N-T.
You don't have to do that, he interrupted. It's not like there are any parents to overhear us.
It was an unusually bitter thing for Jules to say, and Emma swallowed hard.
I know, she said finally, but I like having a secret language with you. I mean, who else can we talk about this stuff with if we don't talk to each other?
He slumped down against the headboard, turning to face her. The truth is, I don't know Uncle Arthur at all. I've only seen him at holidays. I know Helen says she does, and he's great and fine and everything, but they're my brothers and sisters. I know them. He doesn't. He curled his hands into fists. I'll take care of them. I'll make sure they have everything they want, and nothing ever gets taken away from them again. Emma reached for his arm, and this time he gave it to her, letting his eyes fall half-closed as she wrote on the inside of his wrist with her index finger. I-L-L-H-E-L-P-Y-O-U. He smiled at her, but she could see the tension behind his eyes.
I know you will, he said.
He reached his hand out and clasped it around hers. You know the last thing Mark said to me before he was taken? He asked, leaning against the headboard. He looked absolutely exhausted. He said, stay with Emma. So we'll stay with each other, because that's what Parabatai do. Emma felt as if the breath had been pulled out of her lungs. Parabatai. It was a big word for shadow hunters, one of the biggest, encompassing one of the most intense emotions you could ever have, the most significant commitment you could ever make to another person that wasn't about romantic love or marriage. She had wanted to tell Jules when they got back to the house, had wanted to tell him somehow that when she had burst out with the words in the consul's office that they were going to be Parabatai bonded, it had been about more than wanting to be his Parabatai.
Tell him, said a little voice in her head. Tell him you did it because you needed to stay in Los Angeles. Tell him you did it because you need to be there to find out what happened to your parents. To get revenge. Julian, she said softly, but he didn't move. His eyes were closed, his dark lashes feathering against his cheeks. The moonlight coming in through the window outlined him in white and silver. The bones of his face were already beginning to sharpen, to lose the softness of childhood. She could suddenly imagine how he was going to look when he was older, broader and rangier, a grown-up Julian. He was going to be so handsome, she thought. Girls would be all over him. And one of them would take him away from her forever, because Emma was his parabatai. That meant she could never be one of those girls now. She could never love him like that. Jules murmured and shifted in his fitful sleep. His arm was stretched out towards her, his fingers not quite touching her shoulder. His sleeve was rucked up to his elbow. She reached out her hand and carefully scrawled on the bare skin of his forearm, where the skin was pale and tender, unmarked yet by any scars. I am S-O-S-O-R-R-Y. J-U-L-E-S, she wrote, and then sat back, holding her breath. But he didn't feel it, and he didn't wake up. Epilogue. The Beauty of a Thousand Stars. May 2008. The air was beginning to show the first warm promise of summer. The sun shone hot and bright down on the corner of Carroll Street and 6th Avenue. And the trees that lined the brown-stoned block were thick with green leaves. Clary had stripped off her light jacket on the way out of the subway and stood in her jeans and tank top across from the entrance to St. Xavier's, watching as the doors opened and the students streamed out onto the pavement. Isabel and Magnus lounged against the tree opposite her, Magnus in a velvet jacket and jeans and Isabel in a short silver party dress that showed her marks. Clary supposed her own marks were pretty visible too. All up and down her arms, at her belly where the tank top rode up, on the back of her neck. Some permanent, some temporary. All of them marking her out as different. Not just different from the students milling around the school's entrance, exchanging their goodbyes for the day, making plans to walk to the park or to meet up later at Java Jones, but different from the self she had once been. The self who had been one of them. An older woman with a poodle and a pillbox hat was whistling her way down the street in the sunshine. The poodle waddled over to the tree where Isabel and Magnus were leaning. The old woman paused, whistling. Isabel, Clary, and Magnus were completely invisible to her. Magnus gave the poodle a ferocious glare and it backed off with a whimper, half dragging its owner down the street. Magnus looked after them. Invisibility glamours do have their drawbacks, he remarked. Isabel quirked a smile, which disappeared, almost immediately. Her voice when she spoke was tight with repressed feeling. There he is. Clary's head snapped up. The school doors had opened again and three boys had stepped out onto the front stairs. She recognized them even from across the street. Kirk, Eric, and Simon. Nothing had changed about Eric or Kirk. She felt the far-sighted rune on her arm spark as her eyes skipped over them. She stared at Simon, drinking in every detail. It had been December when she'd seen him last, pale and dirty and bloody in the demon realm. Now he was aging, getting older, no longer frozen in time. His hair had gotten longer. It fell over his forehead, down the back of his neck. He had colour in his cheeks. He stood with one foot up on the bottom step of the stairs. His body thin and angular as always, maybe a little more filled out than she had remembered him. He wore a faded blue shirt that he'd had for years. He pushed up the frames of his square-rimmed glasses as he gestured animatedly with his other hand, in which he held a wad of rolled-up papers. Without taking her eyes off him, Clary fumbled her steely out of her pocket and drew on her arm, cancelling out her glamour runes. She heard Magnus mutter something about being more careful. If anyone had been looking, they would have seen her suddenly pop into existence between the trees. Nobody seemed to be, though, and Clary stuffed the steely back in her pocket. Her hand was shaking. Good luck, Isabel said without asking her what she was doing. Clary supposed it was obvious.
Isabel was still leaning back against the tree. She looked drawn and tense, her back very straight. Magnus was busy twirling a blue topaz ring on his left hand. He just winked at Clary as she stepped off the curb. Isabel would never go talk to Simon, Clary thought, starting across the street. She would never risk the blank look, the lack of recognition. She would never endure the evidence that she had been forgotten. Clary wondered if she wasn't some kind of masochist, to throw herself into the path of it herself. Kirk had wandered off, but Eric saw her before Simon did. She tensed for a moment, but it was clear his memory of her had been wiped away too. He gave her a confused, appreciative look, clearly wondering if she was heading toward him. She shook her head and pointed her chin at Simon. Eric raised an eyebrow and gave Simon a "later, man" clap on the shoulder before making himself scarce. Simon turned to look at Clary, and she felt it like a punch to the stomach. He was smiling, brown hair blowing across his face. He used his free hand to push it back. "Hi," she said, coming to a stop in front of him. "Simon." Dark brown eyes shadowed by confusion, he stared at her.
Do we know each other?"
She swallowed back the sudden bitter tang in her mouth. "We used to be friends," she said, and then clarified, "It was a long time ago. Kindergarten." Simon raised a doubtful eyebrow.
"I must have been a really charming 6-year-old if you still remember me."
"I do remember you," she said. "I remember your mom, Elaine, and your sister, Rebecca, too. Rebecca used to let us play with her Hungry Hungry Hippos game, but you ate all the marbles." Simon had gone a little pale under his slight tan.
That did happen, but I was alone," he said, his voice shading past bewilderment into something else.
"No, you weren't." She searched his eyes, willing him to remember something. "I'm telling you, we were friends."
I guess I don't remember," he said slowly,
though there were shadows, a darkness in his already dark eyes that made her wonder. "My mom's getting married," she said. "Tonight. I'm on my way there, actually." He rubbed his temple with his free hand.
"And you need a date to the wedding?"
"No, I have one." She couldn't tell if he looked disappointed or just more confused, as if the only logical reason he could imagine for her to be talking to him had disappeared. She could feel her cheeks burning. Somehow, embarrassing herself like this was harder than facing down a gaggle of Hoosa demons in Glick Park. She ought to know she'd done it the night before. "You and my mom used to be close. I thought you should know. It's an important day, and if things were right, then you would have been there."
Simon swallowed. "I'm sorry."
"It's not your fault," she said. "It was never your fault. Not any of it." She leaned up on her tiptoes, the back of her eyelids burning, and kissed him quickly on the cheek. "Be happy," she said, and turned away. She could see the blurred figures of Isabel and Magnus waiting for her across the street.
"Wait!"
She turned. Simon had hurried after her. He was holding something out. A flyer he'd pulled from the rolled stack he was carrying.
"My band," he said, half apologetically. "You should come to a show, maybe, sometime."
She took the flyer with a silent nod and dashed back across the street. She could feel him staring after her, but she couldn't bear to turn around and see the look on his face. Half confusion and half pity. Isabel detached herself from the tree as Clary hurtled toward them. Clary slowed down just enough to retrieve her steely and slash the glamouroon back into her arm. It hurt, but she welcomed the sting. "You were right," she said to Magnus. "That was pointless."
"I didn't say it was pointless."
He spread his hands wide.
"I said he wouldn't remember you. I said that you should do it only if you were okay with that."
"I'll never be okay with it," Clary snapped, and then took a deep, hard breath. "I'm sorry," she said. "I'm sorry, it's not your fault, Magnus. And Izzy, that can't have been fun for you either. Thank you for coming with me."
Magnus shrugged. "No need to apologize, Biscuit."
Isabel's dark eyes scanned Clary quickly. She reached out a hand. "What's that?" "Band flyer," Clary said and shoved it toward Isabel. Isabel took it with an arched eyebrow. "I can't look at it. I used to help him Xerox those and pass them out." She winced. "Never mind, maybe I'll be glad we came later." She gave a wobbly smile, shrugging her jacket back on. I'm heading out. I'll see you guys at the farmhouse. Isabel watched Clary go, a small figure making its way up the street, unnoticed by other pedestrians. Then she glanced down at the flyer in her hand.
Simon Lewis, Eric Hillchurch, Kirk Duplass, and Matt Charlton. The Mortal Instruments. May 19, Prospect Park, Banshell. Bring this flyer. Get money off your entrance fee.
Isabel's breath hitched in her throat. Magnus. He had been watching Clary too. He glanced over now, and his glance fell on the flyer. They both stared at it. Magnus whistled between his teeth.
The Mortal Instruments?
His band name. The paper shook in Isabel's hand. Okay, Magnus, we have to. You said if he remembered anything.
Magnus glanced after Clary, but she was long gone.
All right, he said. But if it doesn't work, if he doesn't want it, we can never tell her.
Isabel was crumpling the paper in her fist, already reaching for her steely with the other hand.
Whatever you say, but we have to at least try.
Magnus nodded, shadows chasing shadows in his gold-green eyes. Isabel could tell he was worried about her, afraid that she'd be hurt, disappointed, and she wanted to be angry at him and grateful to him all at once.
We will.
It had been another weird day, Simon thought. First, the lady behind the counter in Java Jones who'd asked him where his friend was, the pretty girl who always came in with him and always ordered her coffee black. Simon had stared. He didn't really have any close girlfriends, certainly no one whose coffee preferences he might be expected to know. When he told the barista she must have been thinking of someone else, she'd looked at him like he was crazy. And then the red-headed girl who'd come up to him on the steps of St. Xavier's. The front of the school was deserted now. Eric had been supposed to give Simon a ride home, but he disappeared when the girl had come up to Simon, and he hadn't reappeared. It was nice that Eric thought he could pick up ladies with such blithe ease, Simon thought, but annoying when it meant that he was going to have to take the subway home. Simon hadn't even thought about trying to hit on her, not really. She seemed so fragile despite the fairly badass tattoos that decorated her arms and collarbone. Maybe she was crazy. The evidence pointed that way, but her green eyes had been huge and sad when she'd looked at him. He'd been reminded of the way he'd looked himself, the day of his father's funeral. Like something had punched a hole right through his ribcage and squeezed his heart. Lost like that, no, she hadn't been hitting on him. She'd really believed they'd meant something important to each other once. Maybe he had known that girl, he thought. Maybe it was something he'd forgotten. Who remembered the friends you had in kindergarten? And yet, he couldn't shake an image of her, not looking sad, but smiling over her shoulder at him. Something in her hand, a drawing? He shook his head in frustration. The image was gone like a silver-quick fish slipping off a line. He cast his mind back, desperately trying to remember. He found himself doing that a lot lately. Bits of memories would come to him, fragments of poetry he didn't know how he'd learned, glancing recollections of voices, dreams he'd wake up from shaking and sweating and unable to recall what had happened in them. Dreams of desert landscapes, of echoes, the taste of blood, a bow and arrow in his hands. He'd learned archery in summer camp, but he'd never cared that much about it, so why was he dreaming about it now? Not being able to get back to sleep, the aching sense that there was something missing. He didn't know what, but something, like a weight in the middle of his chest. He put it down to too many D&D campaigns, junior year stress, and worrying about colleges. As his mother said, once you started worrying about the future, you started obsessing about the past. Anyone sitting here? Said a voice. Simon looked up and saw a tall man with spiky black hair standing over him. He wore a velvet prep school blazer with a crest emblazoned on it in glittering thread, and at least a dozen rings. There was something odd about his features.
What? No, Simon said, wondering how many strangers were going to accost him today.
You can sit if you want. The man glanced down and made a face.
I see that many pigeons have pooped upon these stairs, he remarked. I shall remain standing if that's not too rude.
Simon shook his head mutely.
I'm Magnus, he smiled, showing blinding white teeth. Magnus Bane. Are we long-lost friends by any chance? Simon said. Just wondering.
No, we never got along all that well, said Magnus. Long-lost acquaintances, compadres, my cat liked you.
Simon scrubbed his hands over his face. I think I'm going crazy, he remarked to no one in particular.
Well then, you should be all right with what I'm about to tell you.
Magnus turned his head slightly to the side.
Isabel?
Out of nowhere, a girl appeared. Maybe the most beautiful girl Simon had ever seen. She had long black hair that spilled over a silver dress and made him want to write bad songs about starry nights. She also had tattoos, the same ones the other girl had sported, black and swirling, covering her arms and bare legs.
Hello, Simon, she said.
Simon just stared. It was entirely out of the realm of anything he had ever imagined that a girl who looked like this would ever say his name like that. Like it was the only name that mattered. His brain sputtered to a stop like an old car.
Huh? He said.
Magnus held out a long-fingered hand, and the girl placed something into it. A book, bound in white leather with the title stamped on it in gold. Simon couldn't quite see the words, but they were etched in an elegant calligraphic hand.
This, Magnus said, is a book of spells.
There didn't seem to be a response for that, so Simon didn't try for one.
The world is full of magic, said Magnus, and his eyes were sparkling. Demons and angels, werewolves and fairies and vampires, you knew all this once. You had magic, but it was taken from you. The idea was that you would live out the rest of your life without it, without remembering it. That you would forget the people you loved if they knew about magic. That you would spend the rest of your life ordinary.
He turned the book over in his slim fingers, and Simon caught sight of a title in Latin. Something about the sight sent a zing of energy through his body.
And there's something to be said for that, for being relieved of the burden of greatness. Because you were great, Simon. You were a daylighter, a warrior. You saved lives and slew demons, and the blood of angels rocketed through your veins like sunlight.
Magnus was grinning now, a little manically.
And I don't know, it just strikes me as a little fascist to take that all away.
Isabel tossed her dark hair back. Something glittered at the hollow of her throat. A red ruby. Simon felt the same zing of energy, stronger this time, as if his body were yearning towards something his mind couldn't recall.
Fascist? She echoed.
Yes, Magnus said.
Clary was born special. Simon here had specialness thrust upon him. He adapted. Because the world isn't divided into the special and the ordinary. Everyone has the potential to be extraordinary. As long as you have a soul and a free will, you can be anything, do anything, choose anything. Simon should get to choose.
Simon swallowed against his dry throat.
I'm sorry, he said, but what are you talking about?
Magnus tapped the book in his hand.
I've been searching for a way out of this spell, this curse on you, he said.
Simon almost protested that he wasn't cursed, but subsided.
This thing that made you forget, then I figured it out. I ought to have figured it out a lot sooner, but they've always been so strict about ascensions, so particular. But then Alec mentioned to me, they're desperate for new shadow hunters now. They lost so many in the Dark War, it would be easy. You've got so many people to vouch for you. You could be a shadow hunter, Simon, like Isabel. I can do little with this book. I can't fix it completely, and I can't make you what you were before. But I can prepare you to be able to ascend. And once you do, once you're a shadow hunter, he can't touch you. You'll have the Clave's protection, and the rules about not telling you about the shadow world. Those will be gone.
Simon looked at Isabel. It was a little like looking at the sun, but the way she was looking back at him made it easier. She was looking at him as if she had missed him, though he knew that wasn't possible.
There's really magic? He asked. Vampires and werewolves and wizards?
Warlocks, Magnus corrected. And all of that, it exists?
It exists, Isabel said.
Her voice was sweet, a little husky, and familiar. He remembered the smell of sunlight and flowers suddenly, a taste like copper in his mouth. He saw desert landscapes stretching out under a demon sun and a city with towers that shimmered as if they were made of ice and glass.
It's not a fairy tale, Simon. Being a shadow hunter means being a warrior. It's dangerous, but if it's right for you, it's amazing. I wouldn't ever want to be anything else.
It's your decision, Simon Lewis, said Magnus. Remain in the existence you have, go to college, study music, get married, live your life. Or you can have an uncertain life of shadows and dangers. You can have the joy of reading the stories of incredible happenings, or you can be part of the story. He leaned closer, and Simon saw the light spark off his eyes, and realized why he'd thought they were old. They were gold-green and slit-pupiled like a cat's, not human eyes at all. The choice is up to you.
It was always a surprise that werewolves turned out to have such a deft touch with floral arrangements, Clary thought. Luke's old pack, Myers now, had pitched in to decorate the grounds around the farmhouse where the reception was being held, and the old barn where the ceremony had taken place. The pack had overhauled the entire structure. Clary remembered playing with Simon in the old hayloft that creaked, the cracked and peeling paint, the uneven floorboards. Now everything had been sanded down and refinished, and the post and beam room glowed with the soft glow of old wood. Someone had a sense of humor, too. The beams had been wrapped with chains of wild lupine. Big wooden vases held arrays of cattails and goldenrod and lilies. Clary's own bouquet was wildflowers, though it had gone a bit limp from being clutched in her hand for so many hours. The whole ceremony had gone by in something of a blur. Vows, flowers, candlelight, her mother's happy face, the glow in Luke's eyes. In the end, Jocelyn had eschewed a fancy dress and gone with a plain white sundress and her hair up in a messy bun with, yes, a coloured pencil stuck through it. Luke, handsome in dove grey, didn't seem to mind at all. The guests were all milling about now. Several werewolves were efficiently clearing away the rows of chairs and stacking the presents on a long table. Clary's own gift, a portrait she had painted of her mother and Luke, hung on one wall. She had loved drawing it, had loved having the brush and paints in her hands again, drawing not to make runes, but only to make something lovely that someone might someday enjoy. Jocelyn was busy hugging Maya, who looked amused at Jocelyn's enthusiasm. Bat was chatting with Luke, who seemed dazed, but in a good way. Clary smiled in their direction and slipped out of the barn onto the path outside. The moon was high, shining down on the lake at the foot of the property, making the rest of the farm glow. Lanterns had been hung in all the trees and they swung in the faint wind. The paths were lined with tiny glowing crystals, one of Magnus's contributions. Though where was Magnus? Clary hadn't seen him in the crowd at the ceremony, though she'd seen nearly everyone else. Maya and Bat, Isabel in silver, Alec very serious in a dark suit, and Jace having defiantly discarded his tie somewhere, probably in some nearby foliage. Even Robert and Maris were there, suitably gracious. Clary had no idea what was going on with their relationship and didn't want to ask anyone. Clary headed down toward the largest of the white tents. The DJ station was set up for Bat, and some of the pack and other guests were busy clearing a space for dancing. The tables were draped with long white cloths and set with old china from the farmhouse, sourced from Luke's years of scouring flea markets in the small towns around the farm. None of it matched, and the glasses were old jam jars and the centerpieces were hand-picked blue asters and clover floating in mismatched pottery bowls, and Clary thought it was the prettiest wedding she'd ever seen. A long table was set up with champagne glasses. Jace was standing near it, and as he saw her, he raised a glass of champagne and winked. He had gone the disheveled route, rumpled blazer and tousled hair and now no tie, and his skin was all gold from the beginning of summer, and he was so beautiful that it made her heart hurt. He was standing with Isabel and Alec. Isabel looked stunning with her hair swept up in a loose knot. Clary knew she'd never be able to pull off that sort of elegance in a million years, and she didn't care. Isabel was Isabel, and Clary was grateful she existed, making the world a little fiercer with every one of her smiles. Isabel whistled now, shooting a look across the tent. Look at that. Clary looked and looked again. She saw a girl who seemed about 19 years old. She had loose brown hair and a sweet face. She wore a green dress, a little old-fashioned in its style, and a jade necklace around her throat. Clary had seen her before, in Alicante, talking to Magnus at the Claves party in Angel Square. She was holding the hand of a very familiar, very handsome boy with must-dark hair,
He looked tall and rangy in an elegant black suit and white shirt that set off his high cheekbone face. As Clary watched, he leaned over to whisper something into her ear, and she smiled, her face lighting up.
"Brother Zachariah," Isabel said. "Months January through December of the Hot Silent Brothers calendar. What's he doing here?"
"There's a Hot Silent Brothers calendar," said Alec. "Do they sell it?"
"Quit that," Isabel elbowed him. "Magnus will be here any minute."
"Where is Magnus?" Clary asked. Isabel smiled into her champagne. "He had an errand." Clary looked back over towards Zachariah and the girl, but they had melted back into the crowd. She wished they hadn't. There was something about that girl that fascinated her. But a moment later, Jace's hand was around her wrist, and he was setting down his glass.
"Come dance with me," he said.
Clary looked over at the stage. Bat had taken his place at the DJ booth, but there was no music yet. Someone had placed an upright piano in the corner, and Katerina Loss, her skin glowing blue, was tinkling at the keys.
"There's no music," she said.
Jay smiled at her. "We don't need it." "And that's our cue to leave," Isabel said, seizing Alec by the elbow and hauling him off into the crowd. Jace grinned after her.
"Sentimentality gives Isabel hives," said Clary.
"But seriously, we can't dance with no music. Everyone will stare at us."
"Then let's go where they can't see us," Jace said, and drew her away from the tent. It was what Jocelyn called the blue hour now. Everything drenched in twilight, the white tent like a star and the grass soft, each blade shimmering like silver.
Jace drew her back against him, fitting her body to his, wrapping his arms around her waist, his lips touching the back of her neck.
"We could go in the farmhouse," he said. "There are bedrooms."
She turned around in his arms and poked him in the chest firmly.
"This is my mother's wedding," she said. "We're not going to have sex. At all."
"But at all is my favorite way to have sex."
"The house is full of vampires," she told him cheerfully. "They were invited and they came last night. They've been waiting in there for the sun to go down."
"Luke invited vampires?"
"Maya did. Peace gesture. They're trying to all get along."
"Surely the vampires would respect our privacy."
"Surely not," Clary said, and she drew him firmly away from the path to the farmhouse,
into a copse of trees. It was shaded in here and hidden, the ground all packed earth and roots, mountain mint with its starry white flowers growing around the trunks of the trees in clusters. She backed up against a tree trunk, pulling Jace with her, so that he leaned against her, his hands on either side of her shoulders as she rested in the cage of his arms. She smoothed her hands down over the soft fabric of his jacket.
"I love you," she said.
He looked down at her.
"I think I know what Madame Dorothea meant," he said, "when she said I'd fall in love with the wrong person."
Clary's eyes widened. She wondered if she was about to be broken up with. If so, she would have a thing or two to say to Jace about his timing after she drowned him in the lake. He took a deep breath.
"You make me question myself," he said. "All the time, every day. I was brought up to believe I had to be perfect. A perfect warrior, a perfect son. Even when I came to live with the Lightwoods, I thought I had to be perfect, because otherwise they would send me away. I didn't think love came with forgiveness, and then you came along, and you broke everything I believed into pieces, and I started to see everything differently. You had so much love and so much forgiveness and so much faith. So I started to think that maybe I was worth that faith, that I didn't have to be perfect. I had to try, and that was good enough." He lowered his eyelids so she could see the faint pulse at his temple, feel the tension in him. "So I think you were the wrong person for the Jace that I was, but not the Jace that I am now, the Jace you helped make me. Who is, incidentally, a Jace I like much better than the old one. You've changed me for the better, and even if you left me, I would still have that." He paused. "Not that you should leave me," he added hastily, and leaned his head against hers so their foreheads touched. "Say something, Clary." His hands were on her shoulders, warm against her cool skin. She could feel them trembling. His eyes were gold, even in the blue light of twilight. She remembered when she had found them hard and distant, even frightening, before she had grown to realize that what she was looking at was the expert shielding of 17 years of self-protection.
17 years of protecting his heart.
You're shaking, she said with some wonder.
You make me, he said, his breath against her cheek, and he slid his hands down her bare arms.
Every time. Every time.
Can I tell you a boring science fact? She whispered. I bet you didn't learn it in Shadowhunter history class.
If you're trying to distract me from talking about my feelings, you're not being very subtle about it.
He touched her face.
You know I make speeches. It's okay. You don't have to make them back. Just tell me you love me.
I'm not trying to distract you. She held up her hand and wiggled the fingers. There are 100 trillion cells in the human body, she said. And every single one of these cells of my body loves you. We shed cells and grow new ones, and my new cells love you more than the old ones. Which is why I love you more every day than I did the day before. It's science. And when I die, and they burn my body and I become ashes that mix with the air, and part of the ground and the trees and the stars, everyone who breathes that air or sees the flowers that grow out of the ground or looks up at the stars will remember you and love you because I love you that much. She smiled. How was that for a speech? He stared at her, rendered wordless for one of the first times in his life. Before he could answer, she stretched up to kiss him, a chaste press of lips to lips at first, but it deepened quickly, and soon he was parting her lips with his, tongue stroking into her mouth, and she could taste him, the sweetness of Jace spiked with the bite of champagne. His hands were feverishly running up and down her back, over the bumps of her spine, the silk straps of her dress, the bare wings of her shoulder blades pressing her into him. She slid her hands under his jacket, wondering if maybe they should have gone to the farmhouse after all, even if it was full of vampires.
Interesting, said an amused voice, and Clary pulled back from Jace quickly to see Magnus standing in a gap between the two trees.
His tall figure was limned in the moonlight. He had eschewed anything particularly outrageous, and was dressed in a perfectly cut black suit that looked like a spill of ink against the darkening sky.
Interesting, Jace echoed. Magnus, what are you doing here?
Came to get you, Magnus said. There's something I think you should see.
Jace closed his eyes as if praying for patience.
We are busy.
Clearly, said Magnus. You know, they say life is short, but it isn't all that short. It can be quite long, and you have all your lives to spend together, so I really suggest you come with me because you're going to be sorry if you don't.
Clary broke away from the tree, her hand still in Jace's.
Okay, she said.
Okay, said Jace, following her. Seriously?
I trust Magnus, Clary said. If it's important, it's important.
And if it's not, I'm going to drown him in the lake, Jace said, echoing Clary's earlier unspoken thought. She hid her grin in the dark.
Alex stood at the edge of the tent, watching the dancing. The sun was down enough now to simply be a red stripe painted across the distant sky, and the vampires had come up from the farmhouse and joined the party. Some discreet accommodation had been made for their tastes, and they mingled among the others, holding sleek metal flutes plucked from the champagne table, whose opacity hid the liquid inside. Lily, the head of the vampire clan of New York, was at the ivory keys of the piano, filling the room with the sound of jazz. Over the music, a voice said in Alex's ear,
"It was a lovely ceremony, I thought."
Alec turned and saw his father, his big hand clasped around a fragile champagne flute, staring out at the guests. Robert was a large man, broad-shouldered, never at his best in a suit. He looked like an overgrown schoolboy who'd been forced into it by an annoyed parent.
"Hi," Alec said. He could see his mother across the room talking to Jocelyn. Maris had more streaks of grey in her dark hair than he remembered. She looked elegant, as she always did.
"It was nice of you to come," he added grudgingly.
Both his parents had been almost painfully grateful that he and Isabel had returned to them after the Dark War. Too grateful to be angry or scolding. Too grateful for Alec to say much of anything to either of them about Magnus. When his mother had returned to New York, he'd gathered the rest of his possessions from the Institute and moved into the loft in Brooklyn. He was still in the Institute nearly every day. Still saw his mother often, but Robert had remained in Alicante, and Alec hadn't tried to contact him.
"Pretend to be civil with Mum. All of that, really nice,"
Alex saw his father flinch. He'd meant to be gracious, but he'd never done gracious well. It always seemed like lying.
"We're not pretending to be civil," said Robert. "I still love your mother. We care about each other. We just can't be married. We should have ended it earlier. We thought we were doing the right thing. Our intentions were good."
"Road to hell," said Alex succinctly, and looked down at his glass.
"Sometimes," Robert said, "you choose whom you want to be with when you're too young, and you change, and they don't change with you."
Alec took in a slow breath. His veins were suddenly sizzling with anger. "If that's meant to be a dig at me and Magnus, you can shove it," he said. "You gave up your rights to have any jurisdiction over me and my relationships when you made it clear that as far as you were concerned, a gay shadow hunter wasn't really a shadow hunter." He set his glass down on a nearby speaker. "I'm not interested."
"Alec."
Something about Robert's voice made Alec turn. He didn't sound angry, just broken.
I said unforgivable things, I know that," he said. "But I have always been proud of you, and I am no less proud now."
"I don't believe you."
"When I was your age, younger, I had a parabatai," said Robert.
"Yes, Michael Wayland," said Alec, not caring that he sounded bitter, not caring about the look on his father's face. "I know, it's why you took Jace in. I always thought you two must not have been particularly close. You didn't seem to miss him much, or mind that he was dead."
"I didn't believe he was dead," said Robert. "I know that must seem hard to imagine. Our bond had been severed by the sentence of exile passed down by the Clave, but even before that we had grown apart. There was a time, though, when we were close, the best of friends. There was a time when he told me that he loved me."
Something about the weight his father put on the words brought Alec up short.
"Michael Wayland was in love with you." "I was not kind to him about it," said Robert. "I told him never to say those words to me again. I was afraid, and I left him alone with his thoughts and feelings and fears, and we were never close again as we had been. I took Jace in to make up, in some small measure for what I had done, but I know there is no making up for it."
He looked at Alec, and his dark blue eyes were steady.
"You think that I am ashamed of you, but I am ashamed of myself. I look at you and I see the mirror of my own unkindness to someone who never deserved it. We find in our children our own selves again, who might be made better than we are. Alec, you are so much a better man than I ever was or will be."
Alec stood frozen. He remembered his dream in the demon lands, his father telling everyone how brave he was, what a good shadow hunter and warrior. But he had never imagined his father telling him that he was a good man. It was a much better thing, somehow. Robert was looking at him with the lines of strain playing around his eyes and mouth. Alec couldn't help but wonder if he'd ever told anyone else about Michael, and what it had cost him to say it just now. He touched his father's arm lightly, the first time he had willingly touched him in months, and then dropped his hand.
"Thank you," he said, "for telling me the truth. It wasn't forgiveness, not exactly, but it was a start."
The grass was damp from the chill of the oncoming night. Clary could feel the cold soaking through her sandals as she made her way back toward the tent with Jason Magnus. Clary could see the rows of tables being set up, china and silverware flashing. Everyone had pitched in to help out. Even the people she usually thought of as almost unassailable in their reserve. Kadir, Gia, Maris. Music was coming from the tent. Bat was lounging up at the DJ station, but someone was playing jazz piano. She could see Alec standing with his father, talking intently. And then the crowd parted as she saw a blur of other familiar faces. Maya and Aline chatting, and Isabel standing near Simon, looking awkward.
Simon.
Clary came up short. Her heart skipped a beat and then another. She felt hot and cold all over as if she were about to faint. It couldn't be Simon. It had to be someone else, some other skinny boy with messy brown hair and glasses. But he was wearing the same faded shirt she'd seen him in that morning, and his hair was still too long and in his face, and he was smiling at her a little uncertainly across the crowd. And it was Simon. And it was Simon. And it was Simon. She didn't even remember starting to run, but suddenly Magnus's hand was on her shoulder, a grip like iron holding her back.